Kraut was actually saying the word nigger in private. But what they were getting at on the race realism stuff was Kraut assumed that there would be what he called a knockout study on intelligence among racial groups, let's say, and that in other words, there's no inherent IQ disparity between black people and white people. He assumed that there would be one out there. A Naked Ape was telling him that there isn't. And Kraut was saying, well, there must be. And you can see why. And the reason why he thought there must be is because he believed in this post-World War II meta-narrative that there is no races, that it's all just a matter of how people are brought up in the world and all of this. And of course, it's all lies. It's all bullshit. So in this kind of hour of need, he's turning to the friend of his and saying, well, the science must back up the liberalism. And Naked Ape had to scream it in his face and say, it doesn't. The study doesn't exist. We don't have it. You're going to have to accept it. And then there was the other one. You see, this is why I know it's kind of like a nostalgia stream, but it is important because you can see the way that this sort of... There's a lot of political philosophy gets dragged up by this, but it gets kind of revealed to us in the way that they act, in the way that they've responded when their own kind of priors and ideology has been severely exposed. This is people who thought of themselves as being free thinkers. They would go to the places nobody else would. They weren't idea. One of the things they used to always come out with was that they hated ideology. The horseshoe theory thing where the far right and the far left were basically the same. We were all just fascists. Fascists and communists are the same thing. Now, what they were getting at was that if you believe, let's say you believe socialism or communism, and then what you have is a huge kind of ideological construct as to why that all has to happen. And then from their perspective, the far right, or they would just use us as, he'll call us fascists, we didn't actually have an ideology. It was purely negative, but let's just run with it. The idea that white people are safer if they live in white-only countries, basic talking points like that. So it's as if the far right and the far left are ideologues because they've got all of these complicated things which are bolted together, and we believe in our ideology like a religion. That's how they would kind of approach it. But for themselves, for the centrists themselves, they didn't have an ideology, and they would say again and again and again that they hated ideology, and that they would arrive to their conclusions about the world through empiricism and open debate and looking at what the facts were. And the facts don't care about your feelings. And of course, it's the far right and the far left who are just all feelings. And if you are then in this dire hour of need saying, I need this study.
The facts have to match up with my feelings, surely.
The facts have to match up with my feelings. And they didn't. And they just didn't. And he's got his friends screaming and screaming at him, telling him to drop it because it doesn't exist. And he could not accept it. Because what you're actually witnessing there is a man's fundamental core beliefs just evaporating before his face.
Yeah. And there's a poetry to it and a certain tragedy to it. And I think it was genuine. I think it was quite a real thing that was going on there. It was a sort of existential crisis for him.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, I don't know if that's too dramatic, because at the same time you could say, well, it was also ego. He just wanted to just remain the edgiest kid on the block kind of thing. But I think at a deeper level, he really was troubled by all. I mean, because otherwise, why did he keep doing it?
He was willing to lose. This is why you can't just say it. I mean, the tragedy of it is that he was like totally ideologically driven. He didn't give a shit about money. He didn't give a shit about... He lost 55,000 YouTube subscribers. I think all of his Patreons left him. He had to go off and work on a construction site or something. And all of this, he burned through all of his social capital. He was like the number two capo in the Skeptic Empire. And he burned through it all because he wasn't actually just about the facts and the logic. He was purely ideologically driven. He didn't give a shit about money. He didn't give a shit about subs. He just needed his ideology to be right at any cost. And it's one of the like weirdest tales of the internet that I know about.
This is the guy who claims that he doesn't have an ideology, he doesn't have preconceptions, he's purely rational and logical. Yet what you find is, no, he does have presumptions, preconceptions, and when rationality and logic don't meet up with those preconceptions, he goes nuts.
The funny thing is, and it says a lot about the kind of classic liberal mindset, is that the people who were going on kind of rationalism were the people who decided to just start cranking out more videos about feminism and video games. Because they are the ones who thought, it's not going to hurt my bottom line, I'm not risking anything. The rational thing to do here is just to stay well out of whatever the hell's going on with the alt-right crowd. And they did it. In a way, like they rationalized themselves into just being sort of cowards on the sidelines.
Yeah, grifters.
Yeah, so you can't really accuse Kraut of that, in all fairness.
Well, not then.
not in that particular time. But another thing, the other one was that Aidan Paladin was... I remember there was all of the audio leaks that came out, and she was... her leak had her, like, actually crying, telling him, like... Do not take the alt-right on over race. Like, just don't do it. Like, take them on over economics or take them on over, you know, authoritarianism. There's these other issues that you can get them on, but don't go after them on race. And he did it. It was like, don't go after them where they're strongest, you fucking fool. But it's a crazy story, like.
It really is, because he had multiple people telling him, don't do this, stop doing this, retreat, retreat, retreat. And I also think that as it went on, more and more people jumped ship because they realised we cannot win this. And they realised that. He sort of like... What's the term? He lashed himself to the ship's wheel and plunged forward into the icy waters. And he got fucked. And as I had warned him beforehand, he looked stupid at the end of it. Looked stupid. I mean, that's an understatement. He had completely fucked himself. He had no credibility.
He was like Captain Ahab going after Moby Dick. There's just no stopping
him. Yeah. Yes, basically, that is actually an apt...
He's certainly got the pick. Oh, Moby Dick's white as well.
I mean, I all through it, I kind of felt... I did feel sorry for him. But he wasn't a nice... That's the thing. I mean, he wasn't a nice guy. And I remember when I had some trouble a couple of years ago, which was like 3 years after this, he was the first to take revenge and because he wanted revenge. I mean, it clearly still burned him that, well, this had all happened. So when he got a chance to attack me, he did it, which again shows the kind of guy he is. I mean, he is very feminine, frankly. I mean, not feminine, that's not fair. Immature, emotionally immature.
I mean, the sad thing is, in terms of the sort of the YouTube scene, is that it was all it was like the all of it was like the last gasp. You know, it's like I don't know why there was some other reason that I've got this kind of poetic image in my mind of like dinosaurs fighting each other on Earth, and there's the you know this huge beasts kind of launching against each other and chasing each other and all like gang warfare of velociraptors. Who's going to be king of the hill? And then there's just like this meteor comes in from the starts come making its way in through the atmosphere. That was kind of the state of all of us, I think, because it was just they didn't even want the skeptics, because a lot of the times that what because classic liberals were like sort of all about free speech, they would often use language which the censors didn't like, you know, which was not appropriate. Even though they were like total cooks, they would think they could get away with using certain terms and phrases jokingly and all of this. They'd come out with all kinds of foul garbage, to be honest. I mean, that happened to Sargon, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. There was a particular... Yeah, but it's important to say that wasn't on his own channel. That was on some minor, obscure channel, and he thought that it would never be heard by anyone.
Yeah, he was wrong. And you could see that just that general era of people not caring about what they said on YouTube was coming to an end. And none of us really grasped the extent of it, you know?
No, definitely not. I mean, I remember that just after all of this, I had, it was like November, December, I think it started in like August, September. And then in December of 2017, I had Millennial 2017, which was a great success. It was a great feeling, very upbeat. Everyone was very optimistic. And then there was the famous, I think on like the 5th of January, there was the famous stream on Warsky Live, Andy Warsky's channel, with Richard Spencer, Sargon, JF, Andy Warsky, and me, and I think someone else joined as well. But anyway, it was a huge... It was actually the most watched live stream at the time. At that moment, you know, while it was going on, it was the most watched live stream in the world, or on YouTube. And you could see that on the thing at the time. And it was remarkable. And that was the famous one where, well, I said to Sargon, is Lawrence... He refused. He was bullshitting around about the existence of what is white. Well, what is white? Who's white? And so I said to him, well, what do you think, Sargon? Is Lawrence Fishburne white? And I was trying to get him to say, okay, that person is obviously not white, so that we can then... I mean, I was trying to just get him to fucking be serious, be real, drop the bullshit. And that became a sort of meme. And the other thing that happened in that same stream is that Richard Spencer... Well, it was when he said to Sargon, you're not as intelligent as you think you are. And of course, the other thing that came out of that stream was Sargon's famous faux pas about Locke. And I think he said, have you even read Locke? Or something like that. And he was talking about a Jewish economist, Leonard Peikoff, I think it was. And Richard Spencer was just... just easily knocking these things aside as Sargon desperately tried to smuggle his way through this. And it was just a disaster for Sargon. Absolute disaster.
And, I mean, say what you want about what's happened with Spencer, but he did destroy Sargon in that debate. But it's interesting to kind of look at how he did it. And it was because, obviously, being a classic liberal... So Sargon roots everything back to the Enlightenment, and he looks at it. I think he's probably a bit different now, but anyway, it was a kind of the sort of skeptic, sort of classic liberal take in the close and the title was that the West is formed by the ideas that came out of the Enlightenment, And so you, this is what we are. So this is what you are before you are a white person, before you are a black person, before you are a Muslim. Or, well, this with the Muslim, it gets a little bit, you know, that it gets a little bit confused, which they did address, in all fairness. So what you aren't defined by a race, you are defined by the fact that you're born into this world of rights and liberties and freedoms and this and democracy, you know. So you're not, that's what, that's the textbook definition of civic nationalism. And he'd rooted it all back to the Enlightenment, obviously, with people like Locke. And what's, but the thing is, Spencer knew all of that, and it was like, well, this is what I'm against. Like, you're not going to get me by giving me a lecture on the Enlightenment. It's the Enlightenment itself that I find to be the problem. And yes, it was as if the sort of like a sort of trapdoor opened underneath, and it was like, well, holy hell, well, where does this leave us then?
Like, yes,
it's like Spencer's frame was that it's liberalism itself that is the problem. It isn't the case that I'm not going to argue with you within that frame of, well, there's who these this post Enlightenment philosopher or this post Enlightenment philosopher. It's like the whole project is the issue that I have.
Yes. And I think as long as it stays within that frame, the Enlightenment frame, that as long as it stays within that context, Sargon feels or felt at that time that he could win, because he would just refer back to some classical liberal writer and befuddle people. But Spencer was frankly more well-read than him, and more well-read than he was prepared for. He didn't realize. I mean, this was to do with Sargon's hubris. The smuckling, that was a meme for a reason. It was because he did it all the goddamn time. He really did think that he was the dog's bollocks. And that encounter with Spencer, I think, was not just publicly embarrassing, but personally humiliating for Sargon, because it made him realize that his limitations to some extent. And of course, it was very telling, actually, because what he did immediately after that stream, and I mean immediately after that stream, was he went to his own channel, did a live stream with one of his minions, in which he and the minion agreed that he, Sargon, had wiped the floor with Spencer, had obviously won, obviously was triumphant, and had shown him up. But even Sargon's own fans underneath that video were tearing him apart, eviscerating him for not only for losing the debate with Spencer, but for then lying about it afterwards, which is what he did regularly. He would do this every time he debated someone from the alt-right. He would, or indeed every time he talked about the alt-right, Sargon would lie about it. The one that stings me the most is my debate that I did with on Millennial 2017 with Professor Mike Isaacson. And he and I agreed on literally nothing. We had completely different worldviews. But Sargon did a video about that debate in which he painted us as birds of a feather, peas in a pod. Isaacson is far-left communist, Woz is an alt-right identitarian, and they're the same thing. It's the horseshoe. And that pissed me right off. And here's why. Because more people watched his video about the debate than watched the debate. And this is an example of how Sargon abused the power that he had. And it's something that I'm still fucking annoyed with him for to this day, that he would continually lie and lie and lie. And that's why that debate stung him so much, because he couldn't really lie about it. The defeat by Spencer was just so obvious.
I remember Distributors did a great take on everything that happened, like that particular part of Millennial, because, and his point was a good one, and it was that you can sit down with somebody who is so far removed. So if you sit down with some kind of, I don't know if it would be true today, to be honest, with like the woke crowd, where if you're going to sit down with like a tranny and have like a conversation, I don't know what it would just be. I guess it is, because what you're doing is talking to somebody whose values are just so, so alien to yours. There's absolutely no common ground. You can kind of...
That was how I felt with Mike Isaacson, which is why it was so infuriating to hear Sargon lying about it and saying that we had a lot in common. We had nothing in common. We're completely different life forms.
There's no point in even trying to build any bridges, because it's just not going to happen. So all you can do is kind of nod at each other's points and kind of get through it and take it with a bit of humour, because there's just... there's nothing there. All you can do is hope that one day their camp is utterly destroyed.
When
it's somebody who agrees with you on, say, 60 or 70% of things already, then it's like the final kind of 30%. Is you'd think that you'd be able to kind of bury the hatchet, and because you can
at least see each other's point, even if you don't agree with each other, you can see each other's point.
Yeah, but so with the I think there's so much of the problem of the skeptic kind of classic liberals that the alt-right have had is that they actually agree with us on so much, but then they still attack us. So it's as if but we agree on all of this. Can you not just go the extra mile? Can you not just go that extra step and understand, like, say, for example, another thing which we haven't even talked about was this whole idea where everybody is just an individual. That used to drive me nuts. It was clearly, clearly bullshit. I mean, I remember I did a video which was so angry that I had to take it down, because eventually I got onto YouTube as well, where Jordan Peterson was basically, it was like every time I saw Jordan Peterson, he was saying, because he was kind of like the kingpin, he was like the emperor of the classic liberals, he still is, I suppose, and he would rail against young white men seeing themselves as part of a group of young white men.
Absolutely. He said it was his greatest achievement to steer young white men away from nationalism.
And I remember watching that, and then there was a thing happened where it was a young white lad, an English lad, in somewhere like Bradford, and he was on his own, and he was just being mobbed by all of these Pakistani, or whatever they were, like a gang of them. And it clearly looked like a pack. It looked like a pack of hyenas attacking an antelope. And I thought I was just infuriated that these people are peddling this poison to these young white men when there is clearly groups, and you don't even have to kind of go to the other groups and networks who are controlling, say, the media and whatnot, especially in America. But you just on the basic street level, when if you've peddled that kind of individualism to young white men, then and you've told them everybody's just an individual, there's no such thing as collectives, then they will take that on board, maybe, if you are this authority figure, and they will walk through certain parts of London or Bradford or wherever in America, Chicago or somewhere. Why? Because that sense of, well, there's a group over there, but at the end of the day, I've just got to see them all as a collection of individuals and not as a pack. It's retarded, and it's responsible for getting people stabbed and murdered.
Absolutely. I mean, I would love to see Jordan Peterson walk through Baltimore or Detroit or something. Just to see what happened, and to watch his pathetic attempts to refute what was the clear truth all around him. Edifying to see that. Similarly with certain, you know, individualists in Britain. I would like to see them walking around Bradford at night and see what happens. And again, watch them desperately try to perpetuate their delusions. Because these are, this is the thing, it affects everyone. And that gets us in turn to the individualism thing and culture. These notions form the basis for mass immigration, multiculturalism, relativism, and rejecting any kind of white solidarity in each country, Danish solidarity in Denmark, Swedish solidarity in Sweden, English solidarity in England. It's absolutely poisonous and destructive, and it leaves people extremely vulnerable. It means that we cannot create that group that would fight for our rights, because why would we? We're not a group, so we don't need rights. We don't have group rights. We believe in the individual. It's absolutely retarded. And this is the kind of thing that the alt-right concentrated on more in 2018, the following year. I think Jordan Peterson became more of a thing then. And I think that was, yes, that was when I did my speech about Jordan Peterson in February 2018, if I recall correctly, in Estonia. And I imagined that would be the basis for things going forward. It would be individualism versus identitarianism and our collectivism. Sargon at that time was still completely drunk on the Kool-Aid of individualism, and that there were no... I remember him saying, because I put it to him, I put this thing to him, I said, okay, you've conceded, you've said that we're going to be outnumbered by Muslims, you've said we're going to be outcompeted by Jews and high IQ East Asians, you've said that we're going to be outnumbered by Hispanics in America, etc. So what about us? And he said, his response was, I don't recognize an us.
Yeah, I think he's changed his tune on that now, but yeah, that was the sentiment. That was what we were pushing back against.
I want to say this. People keep saying Sargon's changed his tune. Well, you know, a few months ago I watched one of his videos, and he said that he thinks people like us, the alt-right, I think he used the term neo-Nazis, and he said, yeah, I think that they should be exiled from polite society.
Well, there you go. Well,
this guy, I mean, I was, I wouldn't say close to him, but I was in contact with him now and then for a few years. I think he wanted to befriend me because he liked me, but also because he sort of saw me as a bit of a thorn in his side. And so I met him a few times in London, like 2018 onwards, and we got along. He's amiable, but the thing is, he is disingenuous, he is treacherous, and he will twist things, he will misreport things, he will misinterpret things, and ultimately he is, you know, he claimed to be all about values and principles, but really he'll betray those values and principles when it's expedient for him to do so. So now that the YouTube and social media have turned against the idea of freedom of speech, he's no longer a free speech absolutist, and he thinks that neo-Nazis, by which he means people like you and me, should be exiled from polite society. Now, I know that it was just one thing he said in one video, but he's never said anything else. I mean, he's never refuted that. He's never countered it. So I'm going to assume that he stands by that. So how am I meant to like this guy? How am I meant to trust him or admire him? When basically it's a sort of more polite version of what happened with Kraut, where he couldn't beat us, so he just wants us off the playing field. And if that happens by way of censorship by social media, so be it, as long as he remains on the playing field and looking like the edgiest kid on the block.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't watch his stuff. I can't really comment on what his views are now. But one thing I'll say about the individualism thing is that you do notice that it also kind of, even if you leave aside like the ethnic side of it, another thing that it does is bleed straight into this kind of neoliberal economic thing, where even in Jordan Peterson's that horrible conservative manifesto thing he did, I watched AA cover it, but I just couldn't stand it. He just got on my nerves too much. I switched it all off.
It was just stupid,
and I just couldn't be bothered with it. I was just bored with it. But you do notice that the kind of the individualism thing, it bleeds straight into this kind of mindset where you are just this atomized consumer, and this is what they peddle. So even if you put aside the ethnic solidarity element of it, even this the other side of it, which is that you just end up being this kind of economic unit, watching the new shit like Amazon Lord of the Rings thing, and I don't. That's it's not a life.
It's the mass really, consumer. I mean, that's ultimately what they believe in. It's the consumer, and ironically, that's what someone like Vosch believes in. I mean, I think that's ultimately what the SJWs believe in. In the end, everyone is just an atomized consumer consuming the products of his choice. They believe in nothing higher than that.
Yeah, it's horseshoe theory is real, and now it's dominated by a kind of neocon left sort of libertarianism, which is pro-tranny and BLM on one side, and what they assume to be setting up on the other side is kind of dust blowing the dust off Jordan Peterson and wheeling him out to give us a kind of sort of shitty right-wing version of just that, which is probably going to be complaining about cancel culture, you know. So whereas that on the left side of it they will just be all out for hate speech laws and cancelling people and stuff, what you're going to get is that on the right, but they'll like oppose people being debanked.
They'll oppose certain people being debanked, but then 5 years from now they'll be pro those people, those same people being debanked. I mean, they're not going to care about you and me being debunked.
So. I mean, I'll just say one thing, is that the Toby Young thing. So this all of these things about the centrists, now that is just like the centre-right. And the thing with the Tony Young PayPal thing, which happened recently in Britain. So what I thought about doing a video on this, but I've just been so busy with stuff that I didn't get it done. But what I thought was funny about it was that you've got a lot of people coming out, because he's been saying things about vaccines and about transsexuals or whatever. Are these things that the mainstream doesn't want you talking about, basically. And he lost his, in a very milquetoast way as well, I will say. And he lost his PayPal account because of it. Now, politicians like Jacob Rees-Mogg, who are his mates, you know, like backbench Tories and whatnot, are his mates, Toby Young's friends. He's in that kind of scene. They all came out and they complained, and now it's like this big hoo-ha, and PayPal have reinstated him. And what you get is people saying, like, well, this is a victory for free speech. I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I mean, I got banned from PayPal, like, in 2017. But, so it's long gone. But what it does, you know, is that I think it works against us, because we're not going to get our PayPal accounts back. And people are still going to be deplatformed from PayPal if you're crazy enough to still use it. But what it does do is give this pretense that, you see, the censorship isn't that bad because we still have these kind of edgy right-wingers on. And if you think of it as a kind of citadel with a wall going around it, Toby Young is... So this is kind of like the video that I was going to make. Toby Young is basically what they want. It's all been about gatekeeping and kind of controlling the main narrative on this whole conversation that we've had. And Toby Young is basically the guy they want manning the walls of the citadel. And so the problem is, if he is deplatformed, it removes the signifier, if you want. it removes that kind of line over, well, where do we allow the discourse to go to? Who is the outermost edge? Who is on the edge of what is permissible? And if you're going to debunk ban somebody like him from PayPal, that isn't clear anymore.
Yes. It creates a hole in the wall.
Yeah. On the other hand, so that's from the perspective that they want to have somebody there. On the other hand, if you then say, this is why I know that, like, there's not going to be free speech on PayPal. So on the one hand, you get the Citadel wants to have somebody on that kind of wall going around it to mark, to say, wait, this is as edgy as you're allowed to be. But the problem is, if you're then, so then he gets his PayPal account back to demarcate him and is as being in that role. But then if you want to take the other side of the argument, which is that it's going to be extremely difficult for PayPal to ban anybody, that's not going to happen, and it'll not happen because what you're doing is removing the wall. Then there's no longer a clearly defined sort of, basically, we people like us who are now out on alt tech, everything we did on this stream has been off mainstream, you know, where you passed me the link on Telegram and I clicked it and we go through and we're on Odyssey. None of this is all outside of that wall, all outside of the bounds of the Citadel, and they do not want us going back in. And so this is why you're not going to get your PayPal account back. The only thing that the Toby Young saga does is to reinforce that wall that goes around the Citadel.
It could create a certain vulnerability in that what has been shown here, or what people have seen here, is that if someone gets banned from PayPal, and if there's a sufficient backlash, PayPal will back down and the person will get their account back. So you could say it sets a worrying precedent for PayPal. But realistically, I don't think that will happen, because I think the only reason there was such a backlash for Toby Young is his connections. So, you know, other people don't have those connections, so they won't be able to muster a backlash. But I think that the problem with, I mean, and Toby Young actually did say to someone that his group, the Free Speech Union, wouldn't defend someone who, I've forgotten the term, whether it was someone who is racist or whether someone who has made illegal speech, has said has illegal political opinions. So he is a fairly unreliable, I'll put it politely and say that he's fairly unreliable as an ally in all of this. And I think it's just unfortunate that we've got to this point, because we let it get to this point. And, you know, I was trying to get people, bigger figures than me, to create something like the Free Speech Union years ago, so that it wouldn't get to this point. Because, from the start of 2018 onwards, right after that triumphant moment with the Skeptic War and then the Sargon Spencer Warski stream, right after that, things started to darken, both in the real world, with people being banned from Britain, and people within Britain being found guilty, convicted of things, Count Dankula, Tommy Robinson, both within the real world and in the online world, where people, the deplatforming started, everything started getting darker after that moment. And that's a process that is continuing to this day, but I think it's kind of run its course by now, I guess. You might say so. I don't know. The last big banning from YouTube in terms of our guys was Mark Collett a year and a half ago. As far as I know, there haven't been any bans since then. So you could say it's maybe they've just got rid of everyone that they want to get rid of. Maybe they feel that they've broken the back of that ecosystem on there.
Well, they have. I mean, I'm still on there, but I cannot see anything I barely use it. I've done like one video over the last month, and like 90% of my all of my content is on Substack now. And then, even that, like most of it is just exclusive to Substack because I've got no incentive to use YouTube. It's as simple as that. And I know that we're on Odyssey, but I know that there's people on YouTube who, you know, I wish you'd make more videos and it's great. And I mean, I just did a stream before about Oliver Cromwell, and there's certain aspects of Oliver Cromwell where people are, you know, like he is the guy who basically allowed Jews back into England. And I can see in the chat, people want you to get into that. And I got into it, but you've got to use all of this coded language. And then the other lads on the stream were like, oh God, like how do we answer this without like sinking his YouTube channel? And it's shit to, because you're talking about a movie and you're talking about a historical figure and historical facts. Like that whole thing about letting the merchants from Antwerp and Amsterdam, that's got its own Wikipedia page. It's not controversial. You can see that, but that it is what it is, and eventually you just kind of cannot be bothered to use it anymore, except for it's a tightly controlled. You write a script, everything's in the right place, but it's a pain in the arse. And I just, if you look now, at what happens on there now, you know, compared to what it used to be, like the skeptic war that we've been talking about today. Tonight here, you can see that kind of energy, that kind of atmosphere where you've got people engaging. Okay, so in the case of the crowd thing, it went crazy. But by and large, what you've got is adults, not children. Let's not forget, we are all adults engaging in a battle of ideas to try and get to a truth. And it's the whole thing, not just for the alt-right, but for them as well, is being destroyed by the power system.
Yeah, the absolutely. At this stage, the debate is very, it's kind of like frozen. You simply, I mean, I cannot imagine being on YouTube now, doing a live stream on YouTube, I think would be a fucking nightmare today. Whereas when I started in 2014, you could be completely relaxed in front of the camera. As long as you didn't use racial slurs, you would be okay. Literally, that was all. I mean, if you used racial slurs, that you could be in trouble. You might not be, even then. But as long as you didn't use racial slurs, you'd be okay. And you could just relax and speak to the camera, say whatever came up, whatever thoughts came into your mind. And so there was this ease where you might not even say something, you might say something that you didn't even really believe, but it was an interesting thought that occurred to you. You might say something that was not directly relevant, but it came to you and so you said it. Just natural sort of conversational style. I don't think you could ever be like that on YouTube today, because what if you said the wrong thing? What if it could be misconstrued? What if you said something and then it's taken out of context and used to pillory you? They say that you really do. But like an example would be my thing with the when I was talking about what is going to be necessary to protect Europe from refugees coming in on dinghies and boats. And I said something about, is it going to be necessary to torpedo them? That would be a dreadful death to inflict on these people. It'd be terrible. But that's now used to say that I want that. So it was a thought that came into my head, which I said.
Yeah.
And now it's like, that's it. You've said those things. You said those words in that order, which can only mean this one thing. And it means this one thing in every context. And you meant it completely. That kind of scrutiny really just kills any candor. You cannot be candid when you've got this gun pointed at your head like that.
I stopped reading it, but my kind of hope not hate little section that I get each year like the thing that they always bring up is a blog post that I did, which was an original talking point that I used to do in the Telegraph, and I did a full article at my original blog. And the example that I used was that there's a girl, I mean, back, this is going back some years, but there was a girl who lives in my area, and I used to go to work in the morning, and I'd say she's about 14 or 15, and she was like a mouthy girl, but she was full of spirit, let's say that. But I did like her, and more than that, I liked that she, because she had a paper round, and I would see her when I left for work in the morning, and I liked it that I live in an area, not because it's rich, it's not a gated community, it's I'm in North Tyneside, but it's white, and it's non-diverse enough where a 14 or a 15-year-old girl can wander around at 6:30 in the morning doing a paper round and even be a bit cheeky, you know? Like, even take the piss out of me dog when she saw me walking me dog. And I like that. I like to be in that. Now, the premise of my article was basically, like, what would you do to keep that? And if you've got all of these foreigners coming across in boats, like it comes down to it, like, in my, does she then have an absolute right to walk around in safety delivering the papers in the morning, and being a little mouthpiece, but being being safe and secure enough to live like that? And my conclusion was yes. So then the opposition to that argument is to say, okay, so what are you going to do about these immigrants coming in these boats? And I was like, well, they can't be allowed in. And because I actually engaged the lefty with this, and they were like, okay, but they are coming in. And I was like, okay, so in the end, if they don't, they'll have to be bombed. And they were absolutely just, he couldn't believe it. And this is what Hope Not Hate was. He says that these boats have got to be bombed. What I'm doing is putting it in the full context, because yeah. what I'm looking at is the safety of a young English girl to have to deliver papers in the morning, not be groomed, not be bundled into the back of a money bus and raped, not to be filled full of vodka and drugs and pimped out on the streets, to just deliver her papers and be left alone and be safe. That's all I want. And if it has to be where boat after boat after boat is just being blown up, like, nobody, like, I don't want them here. Now, the ideology of a lefty might want them here. The government might want them here. But in my place in the world, we don't. And it's as simple as that. And yeah. If you go back in time to a time where it was like tribal villages, it would make perfect sense. All that's got in the way is a like bunch of modern bullshit.
Yeah, I can actually give you a similar example that's happened to me. At some point, I don't know when it was, but I think it might some hangout. Someone asked me, could the Holocaust? Let me think about this. It must have been, like, could the Holocaust ever be justified? And I said, well, and so instead of just saying, look, the mass killing of innocent people is obviously never a good thing. That's what I should have said. But instead, autistically, I said, well, if it's a choice between my people or the other people, or a foreign people, and if only one of them can survive, then in that case, I would choose for the other group to perish. I don't want it to happen, but in that case, in that circumstance, yes, it could be justified because I care more about my own group. But of course, the way that gets interpreted is Millennial Woes has said that the Holocaust could be justified. So the whole context of the statement is completely removed, and it's just me saying, yeah, I think it could be the right thing to kill 6 million Jews. I mean, no, I don't think, I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, it's just infuriating. But if you say something, I mean, I think this is something that we've had to become familiar with, that whatever you say will be used against you. It doesn't matter if it's actually a fairly reasonable point. And it is a fairly reasonable point to say, I would protect my group. I would save, if it came to a choice between saving my group or saving the other group, I would save my group. That's a perfectly reasonable statement that would have been made by anyone up until a few decades, a few seconds ago. But in this context, no, you can't say it, because you'll simply be framed as a genocidal maniac who harbors this urge to kill, to genocide people. It's just crazy. But this is what I mean about the way the stage has been altered, so that every word is under scrutiny. And what that does to debate, what it does to, I mean, I think that we've actually forgotten, as a culture, as a civilization, we've forgotten what it is to actually be free to speak, free to think. We don't really know what that is anymore. And what it is partly is that your words will not be used against you. They will be taken in good faith. They will be interpreted in a merciful way. That they will, the worst interpretation will not be assumed to be the correct one. Because it is just discussion. It's just conversation. And that is how new ideas are discovered. But I think we've forgotten that completely. We're now in this very binary, and you see this in the World Economic Forum stuff as well, where it's either or, it's yes or no, it's on or off, it's true or false.
I sometimes watch that Dr. John Campbell on YouTube, because he is the most objective. All of the sort of the anti-vax type people, they all think he's too soft. He's too, you know, I like him because he is just reading data from, you know, he knows what he's talking about. He's a doctor. He's just a sensible bloke. And, you know, he'll go through the data on excess deaths and this kind of thing. I don't want to get all in on that now, but one thing that sticks out about it is that at the end of his video, he actually brings up the YouTube terms and conditions, and they state specifically that the vaccines are safe and effective, and that you basically, you're just not allowed to talk about it, you're not allowed to question it. And YouTube is taking their guidance from the World Health Organization, and there's links. So he's like going through these strange things, that there's more heart attacks than normal, that there's more teenage boys dropping dead. There's all of these anomalies that we've now got. And all he is doing is reading through the data and then looking at looking at the camera and saying, like, we could really do with like an investigation into finding out what's going on here. There's possible causes, and then he lists things like people are unhealthy because of lockdown, or the NHS is kind of overrun, and he's coming up with sound explanations. And then at the end he'll pull up the YouTube guidelines, says, just to be clear, I have not said that it is related to vaccination products that are, or this and that. And he literally reads through the YouTube guidelines and says, so there you are. I'm aware that I'm on YouTube, and I'm aware of what the regulations are. It's clear as day. I haven't suggested or implied it is these vaccines. And let's not forget that he has actually he's ticked the other boxes. You know, he's said, you know, maybe it's climate change, maybe people aren't very well these days, maybe the NHS is and then there's another plausible explanation, and he just reads out a load of bureaucratic jargon from YouTube. And the overall effect that gives you is just absolute horror, if I'm honest. We can't live like this.
No, exactly. This is what I mean. How we've forgotten what it is to be actually free to speak. You're not free to speak if you have to do what he's doing there. That's a mockery of intellectual inquiry. It's actually grotesque. For an intelligent man to have to conduct himself like that is degrading. And I think it's meant to be. I mean, I think that's what they're doing. They've stymied debate, they've thwarted freedom of thought to this extent. Because the thing is, they just don't have any interest in freedom of thought or freedom of speech. It's an annoying thing that they've got to pay lip service to still, to some extent, but they really don't give a shit about it. I mean, I think they would ideally just have every video on YouTube being either some stupid bimbo talking about her makeup, or some harmless guy talking about DIY, or a blue-haired SJW telling you to become a tranny.
Yeah, and to be honest, that's kind of what it is. There's a few holdouts there doing regular stuff on there, but yeah, it's a sad story.
Because we should be finishing now. So to link this back to the whole skeptic war thing, we went through the, and of course we could have told a different story, we could have used different examples, different characters, but I think the Crichton Tea thing is a good nexus to work around, and it did culminate not with Crichton Tea, because by then he'd sort of collapsed in on himself and imploded, but with the Warsky debate. And thereafter, Kraut basically disappeared for, I don't know, was it a year and a half? Something like that. And then he actually came back. I didn't know this. At some point he came back and built his channel and actually made a very impressive, I have to say, recovery. And he's now eclipsed his previous subscriber base. I think it was around 150k that he had at the peak then, and he went down to under 100, and he's now up at 400 and, hold on a minute, 478,000. And if you look at his videos, what he does now is
geopolitics, isn't it?
Yeah, it's geopolitics and sort of curios from world history, this or that story from this or that country. And I'm sure it's quite good stuff. I mean, I'm not going to watch it, but I'm sure it's good stuff for what it is. But of course, what it isn't is, rebellious.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not, I don't think he's even making the pretense anymore of being any kind of dissident.
Yeah. In a weird way, I'm kind of like, it's kind of nice to know that he's still out there, but it's what it is. YouTube has an incentive structure which is just towards conformity. I mean, the big thing of the moment, amazingly, is Substack. That's where all the energy's gone to, because. And what's crazy about it is that a few years ago, you know, because I started out blogging, and I've always enjoyed it as a format, and it's weird because it's as if I've gone full circle. The thing with Substack means I do podcasts and things. All of my stuff goes up there. I've just got a new Morgoth and Devas classic movie up there from today. And so it's kind of multifunctional. You can do written blog articles. You can put your videos up there. You can do your blog podcasts and put them up there. And you don't get banned. I haven't heard of it happening yet. And they seem pretty ballsy in their terms and conditions. So the point is that I just find it strange, because people used to say that the video had kind of killed off the blog, which it did. It did for a while, but the incentives against videos are becoming so much that it's like blogging's coming back, and I'm happy to see it, to be honest.
It's interesting. I mean, I could talk all day about this. I think from 2018 onwards, it became ever more. I mean, I got very stressed in 2018 and 19. That was a terrible period for me, because after the high of what we've been talking about, there was the encroaching censorship. The alt-right itself began to fall apart very rapidly. And I was very stressed with it. But part of it was this sense that we were being hemmed in and censored and de-boosted, de-platformed. People were losing, you know, their videos were going, just disappearing. There was the limited state thing that YouTube did for a while. And then on Twitter as well, and of course Facebook and Instagram. And people were being banned from PayPal, from Patreon. It was just a nightmare, actually. It was a very stressful thing to go through, and for the likes of us. And the result of it is this awful landscape that exists now in the mainstream social media platforms, which we've talked about extensively here and elsewhere, and I don't want to go on about it too much. But I think, as you indicate, there are other platforms now like Telegram, Substack, Odyssey, which I think probably will take up the slack. But the thing is, it will never be what YouTube and Twitter were, because the mainstream public aren't on these platforms, and they've got no reason to go to the. I mean, I'm sure that most of the public have never even, like the vast majority of them, will never even have heard of Odyssey. And the vast majority of them certainly will not be on Telegram, even though it is actually a very popular platform. It's the vast majority of people will not be on there. And so it's not going to be what existed in the mid-2010s, which really was, and I believe that we genuinely were changing society. I think that's why they had to get us off there. I think it was a sort of maybe a mistake on their part to allow that to happen. Basically, the YouTube algorithm did what it was supposed to do. It got people to the content that they were interested in and would be interested in. And so it functioned perfectly and thus did something that its owners did not want to happen, namely that certain ideas gained traction.
The funny thing is, the YouTube algorithm, like, it really works if it's just not about politics and whatnot. Like,
oh yeah,
I find it spooky that they've, because I want to kind of head off in a moment, but it just randomly suggested to me a post-punk album from 1977 by a band called Television that I'd never heard of. And another thing that drives me mad about YouTube is the ads. I just cannot deal with the adverts. I clicked on it, and I've just been addicted to that album for the last week or so. I just think it's brilliant. Check it out. It's by a band called Television. It's from 1977, and it's called Marquee Moon. And it's just the funkiest, catchiest, brilliant kind of post punk, kind of like Joy Division but lighter album. And I thought, isn't it weird, of all the hodgepodge of stuff on my kind of homepage of YouTube, that YouTube, they know that I like one of that I like that. On the other hand, then they also know that I like say John David Ebert's kind of doom streams, but they don't suggest them. But yeah,
of course. Sorry, I was just checking entropy. We do have one question on entropy, but before we get to that, just let me wrap this up, because there was one point I wanted to make, and I know that you want to get away very soon. I think that the alt-right in 2017 came out of the Skeptic War victorious. And we had shown up this guy who had tried to delude himself. He had tried to avoid the truth. He tried to obfuscate the truth. And we had won with the truth. And that was the thing. As much as his own missteps played in our favor, ultimately his missteps came from the fact that the truth was on our side and that he was engaging in a lie. So basically, we won because of the truth. And I think that gave us that taught us a very unfortunate lesson, which was that the truth will win and that the truth matters. So even though there was on the horizon and throughout the next year and the next few years there was censorship, we had this assumption that the truth matters. It won us the day in 2017, so it will continue to win us the day. We're going to stick by the truth. And then COVID happened. And do you have anything to say about that, Morgoth? I mean, obviously, we don't need to get into the whole COVID thing, but just to talk about the relationship between the public and the truth.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't want to get into all the COVID stuff yet again. But I mean, it kind of confirmed, if you go back and you think, why is it that we wanted to expand into the territory of the skeptic community back in 2017, it was basically to increase our reach at the expense of theirs. And it's good to look at it just in those terms, because that's the truth. They knew it and we knew it. But all of that is based on an assumption that mass matters, and I think it does. But in the old days, when you would talk about sort of red pilling, the idea was that we would be able to move into more fertile ground, because again, just to say what I said before, you have to remember that originally the alt-right white nationalist scene, it was all about reading sites. It wasn't about this kind of live streaming entertainment. But what we saw was an area where, well, we can move in and onto there. The problem that you had is that we were late comers to YouTube, and a lot of the territory had already been occupied by others. So we had to expand into their market, if you like, into their space.
Yeah.
But all of it was based on this idea of reaching a critical mass of an audience in which change in the real world would come about, and that was understandable, because this was while Donald Trump was just settling in as president, which in large part the sort of the online kind of edgy alt-right was the tip of the spear, the meme war kind of thing. But I think what's happened in the years since is something much more cynical has emerged in what became the dissident right, and what COVID compounded and sort of formalized was a contempt for the normies, which didn't used to be the case. It used to be the case where we were more like these evangelical preachers. We had these a set of bullet points which were the truths. We had the JQ, we had race, we had IQ, we had crime statistics, we had demographics, and we would deliver these truths and get people on board, and it would reach a critical mass of people, and there would be some kind of systemic change, just because of the sheer weight of numbers. And now, it's interesting because, you've got this kind of A's book and everything. At the end of the day, they did have to shut that down. So if the opinion of the masses does not matter whatsoever, then they wouldn't have to just shut it all down. But they did do that. But nevertheless, especially since COVID, I think what's set in is a really much more kind of hardened and cynical attitude towards the masses, and a much sort of concentration on the power, like the dynamics of power, in a kind of ruthless Machiavellian way. There's a sort of ideal, there's an idealism within populism which I think's been kicked out of us.
Yes, I would agree. I also think that there's a more I guess the word would be instrumental attitude towards the truth, where we used to think that the truth was just valuable and could just be spread out there Whereas now I think there's more of an attitude that the truth is something that needs to be used judiciously. And indeed, a lot of it is just irrelevant because the masses won't respond to it. It won't work. It won't resonate with them. They just don't need to hear it. They need, and sometimes the masses will be more easily swayed with a lie than with a simple lie than with a complicated truth. I think this cynical attitude has developed, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I wouldn't want to advocate it, but I do think the idea that the truth in and of itself it will save the day, I think, has really fallen by the wayside, because we've seen over the last 2.5 years or whatever that what really sways things is power, and power doesn't give a shit about the truth. The power authors the narrative. Power decides what people will believe, what people will say, what people will do, and the truth in that context, the truth just doesn't come into it. It just doesn't matter. So I think it's really, yeah, indeed, that idealism has been knocked out of us. Yeah, it's sad in a way. But, you know, I think in a sense we had it too easy on social media for a while. We genuinely thought that if we speak truthfully and honestly, then people will keep coming to us. And I think with a level playing field, they would have. But what we didn't realise was that the powerful will not allow us to have a level playing field, because that doesn't work for them.
It's easy to forget as well that originally a platform like YouTube, it was created by people who did have a centrist sort of liberal mindset. Whereas, I mean, I remember when in the early days on YouTube, there was fully monetized Holocaust denial videos. Like there was a really famous one which had like 500,000 views, called "The Last Days of the Great Lie," fully monetized, all William Pierce's podcasts, and they would be like 20 minutes long, and you would have these people had done these graphics, probably look a bit dated by today's standards, but you know, whatever. You could go on YouTube and watch like William Pierce talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and sort of their influence in the Bolshevik Revolution or whatever, and it would have ads on it, and the it says that the people who designed it originally, who were just kind of white, not liberals, but in the sort of classic sense. Where it was like, well, you can just say whatever you want. There's no danger to society. And of course, it was a danger to society because we were living in a lie.
Yes.
We were living in a sort of layers and layers of lies. And when you have an emergent technology like that, which is to say that, well, you can just go on there, you know, this kind of 90s attitude, which they would have had, or 80s or 90s free-spirited attitude, which was like, well, you know, the truth is out there, bro.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it really came of, it gestated, it developed in the mid and late 2000s when Obama had just been elected. And at that point, America was in this post-racial president, the post-racial age. So sort of affirming the end of history narrative, that the conflicts have all been resolved and the truth wins out. You know, it's the post-war truth, but still, we as far as we are concerned, it's the truth. And so clearly, the open marketplace of ideas results in good things happening. So that's and that, I think, that's the mentality that birthed social media like Twitter and YouTube.
There's a trend emerging. This is my last kind of point. There's a trend emerging, because this could have been a whole stream in itself, and we kind of touched on it before we went live. And there's a trend emerging across the West which I find really uncomfortable. And so the last time we spoke, I talked about the Arn Hesh death. And there's a thing, it's not that I'm into, I don't know anything about the kind of the sort of Hollywood pedo things. That's never been part of my content. I've never focused on that. But when you see and the Anne Hesh thing where she was bundled on the ambulance, and then died in the hospital, and you could see there was clearly a woman in distress, and she was clearly trying to get off the gurney, and the men with the fire brigade uniforms on, they were just cold. They didn't care. They didn't try to comfort her. They just chucked her on the back of the ambulance, and then within 24 hours or whatever, she's having her organs harvested. I just found that horrific in and of itself. But what that speaks to, if your suspicions are correct, is this mindset where the authority, it doesn't care that you're in stress and that you're scared. It's all your destiny is already sort of preordained. It and they just don't care it from that perspective what she's thinking, because she doesn't have a future. She's not coming back to get them. And I look at these trends. This is why I got so hung up on the vaccine, because it's everybody, look at it, it's everywhere now. You know, everybody's talking about it now. And yet the power structure is not even acknowledging that it's a thing. Somebody sent me a screenshot before that the FDA in America has said that they're not even going to invest, they're not even going to publish the results of autopsies of people who died because with the vaccine. They're just not going to do it. They're not going to tell you. You look at what's happened this week with the pipeline in Germany. Now, the German pipeline, I would say once again, that is really bad. The Germans are screwed now. They can't turn back. And there's something that it's like they just don't care if you're angry. And that, you know, you can say, well, that's always been the case. It isn't. This is new. They would at least try. So it gets to the point where they hardly even need the censorship anymore, because they just don't give a shit what you're saying. Because we're heading to a very, very dark place. You know, what if they just kind of half-heartedly cover up the most egregious crimes, and in the end, it's like, we don't care if you know we're lying, because you're not coming back from this. You're never going to take us down.
Yeah. Yeah, and that could apply to Anne Hesh, or it could apply to Germany. You know, the US doing what it's done to Germany.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think there's a lot that could be said here about the nature of power, the nature of truth, and especially from the point of view of the skeptics versus alt-right thing in 2017, because the alt-right back then was advocating a type of authoritarianism, whereas the skeptics were just wanting to be sort of 90s liberals and detached from everything. It's interesting how it actually develops. We end up being the ones who are craving liberty and wanting the truth to reign and things to be honest and people to be free. Whereas the skeptics end up just going along to get along. That seems to be how they're still on YouTube and doing well. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a sort of superficial reading of it, but I know that time is limited, so that's what I'll confine it to. I should just read this super chat from Rick. He says, very small white pill. Labour want to scrap first past the post and bring in proportional representation. That's the voting system in Britain. That gives a much better chance of getting a nationalist party into Parliament to influence policy. I know that voting won't remove them, but it's something. Well, there we go. That's I hope you're right, Rick.
It's something. I know that it's tempting to say, oh, well, it wouldn't matter, and blah, blah. It's something. We can't. We got to take what we get, and we don't get much.
Yeah. Who knows? It might lead to something. All right, so let's leave it there. So, okay, well, this has been a one-off episode I think Greg will be back next week with the usual setup. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Thank you for the super chats. And yeah, I hope you've enjoyed this. This is Morgoth and me, Millennial Woes. Oh, and I should say, someone asked for my Substack, so I've posted it in the Odyssey chat. There it is again. All right, in the meantime, thank you everyone for listening. Good night.